out of the silent planet continued. "More than 10 days' journey to the west," said Snorra. "The Harandra sinks down, not into a Handramit, but into a broad place, an open place, spreading every way. 5 days' journey from the north to the south of it, 10 days' journey from the east to the west. The forests are of other colors there than here. They are blue and green. It is very deep there. It goes to the roots of the world. The best things that can be dug out of the earth are there. The Pfiffeltriggi live there. They delight in digging. What they dig, they soften with fire and make things of it. They are little people, smaller than you, long in the snout, pale, busy. They have long limbs in front. No Snahu can match them in making and shaping things as none can match us in singing. But let a man see." He turned and spoke to one of the younger Hrossa, and presently, passed from hand to hand, there came to him a little bowl. He held it close to the firelight and examined it. It was certainly of gold, and Ransom realized the meaning of Divine's interest in Malakandra. "Is there much of this thing?" he asked. "Yes," he was told. "It was washed down in most of the rivers, but the best and most was among the Pfiffeltriggi, and it was they who were skilled in it. Arbol Hru, they called it, sun's blood." He looked at the bowl again. It was covered with fine etching. He saw pictures of Hrossa and of smaller, almost frog-like animals, and then of Sorns. He pointed to the latter inquiringly. "Sereni," said the Hrossa, confirming his suspicions. "They live up almost in the Harandra, in the big caves." The frog-like animals, or taper-headed, frog-bodied animals, were Pfiffeltriggi. Ransom turned it over in his mind. On Malakandra, apparently, three distinct species had reached rationality, and none of them had yet exterminated the other two. It concerned him intensely to find out which was the real master. "Which of the Snahu rule?" he asked. "Oyasa rules," was the reply. "Is he Snahu?" This puzzled them a little. The Sereni, they thought, would be better at that kind of question. Perhaps Oyasa was Hanahu, but a very different Hanahu. He had no death and no young. "These Sereni know more than the Hrossa?" asked Ransom. This produced more a debate than an answer. What emerged finally was the Sereni or Sorns were perfectly helpless in a boat, and could not fish to save their lives, could hardly swim, could make no poetry, and even when Hrossa had made it for them, could understand only the inferior sorts. But they were admittedly good at finding out things about the stars, and understanding the darker utterances of Oyasa, and telling what happened in Malakandra long ago, longer ago than anyone could remember. Ah, the intelligentsia, thought Ransom. They must be the real rulers, however it is disguised. He tried to ask what would happen if the Sorns used their wisdom to make the Hrossa do things. This was as far as he could get in his halting Malakandrian. The question did not sound nearly so urgent in this form as it would have done if he had been able to say, used their scientific resources for the exploitation of their uncivilized neighbors. But he might have spared his pains. The mention of the Sorns' inadequate appreciation of poetry had diverted the whole conversation into literary channels. Of the heated and apparently technical discussion which followed, he understood not a syllable. Naturally, his conversations with the Hrossa did not all turn on Malakandra. He had to repay them with information about Earth. He was hampered in this both by the humiliating discoveries which he was constantly making of his own ignorance about his native planet, and partly by his determination to conceal some of the truth. He did not want to tell them too much of our human wars and industrialisms. He remembered how H.G. Wells's Cavour had met his end on the moon. Also, he felt shy. A sensation akin to that of physical nakedness came over him whenever they questioned him too closely about men, the Hmana, as they called them. Moreover, he was determined not to let them know that he had been brought here to be given to the Sorns, for he was becoming daily more certain that these were the dominant species. What he did tell them fired the imagination of the Hrossa. They all began making poems about the strange Handra, where the plants were hard like stone, and the earth weed green like rock, and the waters cold and salt, and Hmana lived out on top, on the Harandra. They were even more interested in what he had to tell them of the aquatic animal with snapping jaws, which he had fled from in their own world, and even in their own Hadramit. It was a Hanakra, they all agreed. They were intensely excited. There had not been a Hanakra in the valley for many years. The youth of the Hrossa got out their weapons, primitive harpoons with points of bone, and the very cubs began playing at Hanakra hunting in the shallows. Some of the mothers showed signs of anxiety and wanted the cubs to be kept out of the water, but in general the news of the Hanakra seemed to be immensely popular. Hyoi set off at once to do something to his boat, and Ransom accompanied him. He wished to make himself useful, and was already beginning to have some vague capacity with the primitive Hrossian tools. They walked together to Hyoi's creek, a stone's throw through the forest. On the way, where the path was single and Ransom was following Hyoi, they passed a little she-horse, not much more than a cub. She spoke as they passed, but not to them. Her eyes were on a spot about 5 yards away. "Who do you speak to, Freaky?" said Ransom. "To the Eldil." "Where? Did you not see him?"
"I saw nothing."
"There, there!" she cried suddenly. "Ah, he is gone. Did you not see him?"
"I saw no one."
"Hyoi," said the cub, "the man cannot see the Eldil." But Hyoi, continuing steadily on his way, was already out of earshot, and had apparently noticed nothing. Ransom concluded that Hariki was pretending, like the young of his own species. In a few moments he rejoined his companion. Chapter 12. They worked hard at Hyoi's boat till noon, and then spread themselves on the weed close to the warmth of the creek, and began their midday meal. The warlike nature of their preparations suggested many questions to Ransom. He knew no word for war, but he managed to make Hyoi understand what he wanted to know. Did Serenny and Hrossa and Pfiffeltriggy ever go out like this, with weapons, against each other?
"What for?" asked Hyoi.
It was difficult to explain. "If both wanted one thing and neither would give it," said Ransom, "would the other at last come with force? Would they say, 'Give it or we kill you'?"
"What sort of thing?"
"Well, food, perhaps." "If the Knahu wanted food, why should we not give it to them? We often do." "But how if we had not enough for ourselves?"
"But Maleldil will not stop the plants growing."
"Hyoi, if you had more and more young, would Maleldil broaden the Hadramit and make enough plants for them all?"
"The Serenny know that sort of thing. But why should we have more young?"
Ransom found this difficult. At last he said, "Is the begetting of young not a pleasure among the Hrossa?"
"A very great one, man.
This is what we call love."
"If a thing is a pleasure, a man wants it again. He might want the pleasure more often than the number of young that could be fed."
It took Hyoi a long time to get the point.
"You mean," he said slowly, "that he might do it not only in 1 or 2 years of his life, but again?"
"Yes."
"But why? Would he want his dinner all day, or want to sleep after he had slept?"
"I do not understand."
"But a dinner comes every day. This love, you say, comes only once while the horse lives."
"But it takes his whole life. When he is young, he has to look for his mate. And then he has to court her. Then he begets young. Then he rears them. Then he remembers all this and boils it inside him and makes it into poems and wisdom."
"But the pleasure he must be content only to remember."
"That is like saying, 'My food I must be content only to eat.'"
"I do not understand."
"A pleasure is full grown only when it is remembered."
"You are speaking, man, as if the pleasure were one thing and the memory another. It is all one thing. The Serenny could say it better than I say it now. Not better than I could say it in a poem. What you call remembering is the last part of the pleasure, as the kra is the last part of a poem. When you and I met, the meeting was over very shortly. It was nothing. Now it is growing something as we remember it. But still we know very little about it. What it will be when I remember it as I lie down to die, what it makes in me all my days till then, that is the real meeting. The other is only the beginning of it. You say you have poets in your world. Do they not teach you this?"
"Perhaps some of them do," said Ransom. "But even in a poem does a cross never long to hear one splendid line over again?"
Hyoi's reply unfortunately turned on one of those points in their language which Ransom had not mastered. There were two verbs which both, as far as he could see, meant to long or yearn. But the Hrossa drew a sharp distinction, even an opposition between them. Hjoy seemed to him merely to be saying that everyone would long for it, one alone, but no one in his senses could long for it. Thrumpheline. And indeed, he continued, the poem is a good example, for the most splendid line becomes fully splendid only by means of all the lines after it. If you went back to it, you would find it less splendid than you thought. You would kill it. I mean in a good poem. But in a bent poem, Hjoy? A bent poem is not listened to, Herman. And how of love in a bent life? How could the life of Achnahu be bent? Did you say, Hjoy, that there are no bent Hrossa? Hjoy reflected. I have heard, he said at last, of something like what you mean. It is said that sometimes here and there a cub at a certain age gets strange twists in him. I have heard of one that wanted to eat earth. There might perhaps be somewhere a Hross, likewise, that wanted to have the years of love prolonged. I have not heard of it, but it might be. I have heard of something stranger. There is a poem about a Hross who lived long ago in another Hadramit, who saw things all made two suns in the sky, two heads on a neck. And last of all, they say that he fell into such a frenzy that he desired two mates. I do not ask you to believe it, but that is the story, that he loved two Hresni. Ranson pondered this. Here, unless Hjoy was deceiving him, was a species naturally continent, naturally monogamous. And yet, was it so strange? Some animals, he knew, had regular breeding seasons, and if nature could perform the miracle of turning the sexual impulse outward at all, why could she not go further and fix it, not morally, but instinctively, to a single object? He even remembered dimly having heard that some terrestrial animals, some of the lower animals, were naturally monogamous. Among the Hrossa, anyway, it was obvious that unlimited breeding and promiscuity were as rare as the rarest perversions. At last it dawned upon him that it was not they, but his own species, that were the puzzle. That the Hrossa should have such instincts was mildly surprising. But how came it that the instincts of the Hrossa so closely resembled the unattained ideals of that far-divided species, man, whose instincts were so deplorably different? What was the history of man? But Hjoy was speaking again. Undoubtedly, he said, Maleldil made us so. How could there ever be enough to eat if everyone had 20 young? And how could we endure to live and let time pass if we were always crying for one day or one year to come back? If we did not know that every day in a life fills the whole life with expectation and memory, and that these are that day. All the same, said Ranson, unconsciously nettled on behalf of his own world, Maleldil has let in the Hanakra. Oh, but that is so different. I long to kill this Hanakra, as he also longs to kill me. I hope that my ship will be the first, and I the first in my ship with my straight spear when the black jaws snap. And if he kills me, my people will mourn, and my brothers will desire still more to kill him. But they will not wish that there were no Hanaraki, nor do I. How can I make you understand when you do not understand the poets? The Hanakra is our enemy, but he is also our beloved. We feel in our hearts his joy as he looks down from the mountain of water in the north where he was born. We leap with him when he jumps the falls. And when winter comes, and the lake smokes higher than our heads, it is with his eyes that we see it, and know that his roaming time has come. We hang images of him in our houses, and the sign of all the Hrossa is a Hanakra. In him the spirit of the valley lives, and our young play at being Hanaraki as soon as they can splash in the shallows. And then he kills them? Not often, then. The Hrossa would be bent Hrossa if they let him get so near. Long before he had come down so far, we should have sought him out. No, Haman, it is not a few deaths roving the world around him that make Achnahu miserable. It is a bent Achnahu that would blacken the world. And I say also this. I do not think the forest would be so bright, nor the water so warm, nor love so sweet, if there were no danger in the lakes. I will tell you a day in my life that has shaped me. Such a day as comes only once, like love, or serving Oyasa in Meldalon. Then I was young, not much more than a cub, when I went far, far up the Handramit to the land where stars shine at midday and even water is cold. A great waterfall I climbed. I stood on the shore of Balki, the pool, which is the place of most awe in all worlds. The walls of it go up for ever and ever, and huge and holy images are cut in them, the work of old times. There is the fall called the Mountain of Water. Because I have stood there alone, Meleldil and I, for even Oyasa sent me no word, my heart has been higher, my song deeper, all my days. But do you think it would have been so unless I had known that in Balki, Hanariki dwelled? There I drank life, because death was in the pool. That was the best of drinks, save one. What one? Asked Ransom. Death itself, in the day I drink it and go to Meleldil. Shortly after that they rose and resumed their work. The sun was declining as they came back through the wood. It occurred to Ransom to ask Hjoy a question. Hjoy, he said, it comes into my head that when I first saw you, and before you saw me, you were already speaking. That was how I knew that you were Hnau, for otherwise I should have thought you a beast and run away. But who are you speaking to? To an Eldil. What is that? I saw no one. Are there no Eldilla in your world, man? That must be strange. But what are they? They come from Oyasa. They are, I suppose, a kind of Snahu. As we came out today, I passed a child who said she was talking to an Eldil, but I could see nothing. One can see by looking at your eyes, man, that they are different from ours. But Eldilla are hard to see. They are not like us. Light goes through them. You must be looking in the right place and the right time. And that is not likely to come about unless the Eldil wishes to be seen. Sometimes you can mistake them for a sunbeam, or even a moving of the leaves. But when you look again, you see that it was an Eldil, and that it is gone. But whether your eyes can ever see them, I do not know. The Serenity would know that. Chapter 13. The whole village was astir next morning before the sunlight, already visible on the Harandra, had penetrated the forest. By the light of the cooking fires, Ransom saw an incessant activity of Hrossa. The females were pouring out steaming food from clumsy pots. Hnoha was directing the transportation of piles of spears to the boats. Hjoy, in the midst of a group of the most experienced hunters, was talking too rapidly and too technically for Ransom to follow. Parties were arriving from the neighboring villages, and the cubs, squealing with excitement, were running hither and thither among their elders. He found that his own share in the hunt had been taken for granted. He was to be in Hjoy's boat with Hjoy and Hwin. The two Hrossa would take it in turns to paddle, while Ransom and the disengaged Hross would be in the bows. He understood the Hrossa well enough now to know that they were making him the noblest offer in their power, and that Hjoy and Hwin were each tormented by the fear lest he should be paddling when the Hanakra appeared. A short time ago, in England, nothing would have seemed more impossible to Ransom than to accept the post of honor and danger in an attack upon an unknown but certainly deadly aquatic monster. Even more recently, when he had first fled from the Sorns, or when he had lain pitying himself in the forest by night, it would hardly have been in his power to do what he was intending to do today. For his intention was clear. Whatever happened, he must show that the human species also were Hnau. He was only too well aware that such resolutions might look very different when the moment came, but he felt an unwonted assurance that somehow or other he would be able to go through with it. It was necessary, and the necessary was always possible. Perhaps, too, there was something in the air he now breathed, or in the society of the Hrossa, which had begun to work a change in him. The lake was just giving back the first rays of the sun when he found himself kneeling side by side with Hwin, as he had been told to, in the bows of Hjoy's ship, with a little pile of throwing spears between his knees and one in his right hand, stiffening his body against the motion as Hjoy paddled them out into their place. At least 100 boats were taking part in the hunt. They were in 3 parties. The central, and far the smallest, was to work its way up the current by which Hjoy and Ransom had descended after their first meeting. Longer ships than he had yet seen, 8 paddled ships, were used for this. The habit of the Nakra was to float down the current whenever he could. Meeting the ships, he would presumably dart out of it into the still water to left or right. Hence, while the central party slowly beat up the current, the lightships, paddling far faster, would cruise at will up and down either side of it to receive the quarry as soon as he broke what might be called his cover. In this game, numbers and intelligence were on the side of the Hrossa. The Hanakra had speed on his side and also invisibility, for he could swim underwater. He was nearly invulnerable, except through his open mouth. If the two hunters in the bows of the boat he made for muffed their shots, this was usually the last of them and of their boat. In the light skirmishing parties, there were two things a brave hunter could aim at. He could keep well back and close to the longships, where the Hanakra was most likely to break out, or he could get as far forward as possible in the hope of meeting the Hanakra, going at its full speed and yet untroubled by the hunt, and of inducing it, by a well-aimed spear, to leave the current then and there. One could thus anticipate the beaters and kill the beast, if that was how the matter ended, on one's own. This was the desire of Hjoy and Wim, and almost, so strongly they infected him, of Ransom. Hence, hardly had the heavy craft of the beaters begun their slow progress up current amid a wall of foam, when he found his own ship speeding northward as fast as Hjoy could drive her, already passing boat after boat and making for the freest water. The speed was exhilarating. In the cold morning, the warmth of the blue expanse they were clearing was not unpleasant. Behind them arose, re-echoed from the remote rock pinnacles on either side of the valley, the bell-like, deep-mouthed voices of more than 200 Hrossa, more musical than a cry of hounds, but closely akin to it in quality as in purport. Something long sleeping in the blood awoke in Ransom. It did not seem impossible at this moment that even he might be the Hanakra slayer, that the fame of Man Nakrapunt might be handed down to posterity in this world that knew no other man. But he had had such dreams before, and knew how they ended. Imposing humility on the newly risen riot of his feelings, he turned his eyes to the troubled water of the current which they were skirting, without entering, and watching intently. For a long time nothing happened. He became conscious of the stiffness of his attitude, and deliberately relaxed his muscles. Presently, Wynn reluctantly went aft to paddle, and Hjoy came forward to take his place. Almost as soon as the change had been effected, Hjoy spoke softly to him, and said, without taking his eyes off the current, "There is an Eldil coming to us over the water." Ransom could see nothing, or nothing that he could distinguish from imagination and the dance of sunlight on the lake. A moment later, Hjoy spoke again, but not to him. "What is it, Skyborn?" What happened next was the most uncanny experience Ransom had yet had on Malacandra. He heard the voice. It seemed to come out of the air, about a yard above his head, and it was almost an octave higher than the Hrossa's, higher even than his own. He realized that a very little difference in his ear would have made the Eldil as inaudible to him as it was invisible. "It is the man with you, Hjoy," said the voice. "He ought not to be there. He ought to be going to Oyarsa. Bent Hnau of his own kind from Thulkandra are following him. He should go to Oyarsa. If they find him anywhere else, there will be evil." "He hears you, Skyborn," said Hjoy. "And have you no message for my wife? You know what she wishes to be told." "I have a message for Hleri," said the Eldil, "but you will not be able to take it. I will go to her now myself. All that is well. Only let the man go to Oyarsa." There was a moment's silence. "He is gone," said Wynn, "and we have lost our share in the hunt." "Yes," said Hjoy with a sigh. "We must put Man ashore and teach him the way to Meldilorn." Ransom was not so sure of his courage, but that one part of him felt an instant relief at the idea of any diversion from their present business. But the other part of him urged him to hold on to his newfound manhood. Now or never, with such companions or with none, he must leave a deed on his memory instead of one more broken dream. It was in obedience to something like conscience that he exclaimed, "No, no, there is time for that after the hunt. We must kill the Hanakra first." "Once an Eldil has spoken," began Hjoy, when suddenly Wynn gave a great cry, a bark, Ransom would have called it 3 weeks ago, and pointed. There, not a furlong away, was the torpedo-like track of foam. And now, visible through the wall of the foam, they caught the metallic glint of the monster's sides. Quinn was paddling furiously. Hyoy threw and missed. As his first spear smote the water, his second was already in the air. This time it must have touched the Hanakra. He wheeled right out of the current. Ransom saw the great black pit of his mouth open twice, and twice shut with its snap of shark-like teeth. He himself had thrown now, hurriedly, excitedly, with unpracticed hand. "Back!" shouted Hyoy to Wynne, who was already backing water with every pound of his vast strength. Then all became confused. He heard Wynne shout, "Shore!" There came a shock that flung him forward almost into the Hanakra's jaws, and he found himself at the same moment up to his waist in water. It was at him the teeth were snapping. Then as he flung shaft after shaft into the great cavern of the gaping brute, he saw Hyoy perched incredibly on its back, on its nose, bending forward and hurling from there. Almost at once the cross was dislodged and fell with a wide splash nearly 10 yards away. But the Hanakra was killed. It was wallowing on its side, bubbling out its black life. The water around him was dark and stank. When he recollected himself, they were all on shore, wet, steaming, trembling with exertion, and embracing one another. This story is continued on cassette number 4, side 1.